Hi there, and welcome back to Crypto Clarified. This is the podcast series where we come together to discuss the most captivating headlines and trends from the crypto space. We also have great guests on, which is a total plus. My name is Benjamin Dean. I am director in WisdomTree's digital assets team. Today, I've got the pleasure of being joined by Yasin Amandra, crypto lead at ARK Invest, and David Well, who is the research associate also at ARK Invest. Both work on the crypto space. They're very deep subject matter experts. It's going to be a terrific show. So hang in there. We've got to first do the social media shout outs. For those of you in the US, check out wisdomtreeprime.com, Apple or Android app stores, whatever you like. It's there. It's live. Check it out. Hit subscribe. Make your life easier. It's really satisfying. You hit the subscribe button. Podcasts turn up in your app. Easy, easy stuff. Make your lives easier. You can find me, as always, on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. On today's episode, Yasin and David are going to talk to us a bit about the value proposition of open networks and open source software. We're going to turn to on-chain analytics. We're going to tease out where the signal is amongst all the noise. Fascinating stuff. As always, we're going to finish up with a thinking about the future, because there's nothing we love more than clarifying crypto. It's thinking about the future, capital F. Before we start, though, shout out to Sam and James in compliance. Before I begin, I have to state the following to clarify: the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of WisdomTree and ARK Invest, subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, nor as investment or tax advice. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are not a recommendation, offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, and reliance upon them is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember, past performance is no indication of future results. Right, that's all out of the way. Let's get on to the fun stuff. Yasin, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Benjamin. Super excited for this conversation.
Yeah, it's going to be super cool. David, welcome to you as well. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So usually we kick these episodes off with guests, just giving the listeners some background on who they are, how they got involved in this space, why they found it so interesting. Let's kick off your scene. Just give them a quick brief on you, your background, what you do at ARK, all interesting stuff.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I lead crypto at ARK. I joined in July of 2018, so a little over 5 years ago. Out of college, I studied at the University of Pennsylvania, and a dual degree between systems engineering and finance, and was very fascinated by the intersection between really finance and technology. So fell down the crypto rabbit hole in 2017, stumbled upon ARK, reached out to them through Twitter, was kind of very adamant on finding a role full time at the time, and was very lucky to have stumbled upon them. So really the rest is history. My main focus is on both research and product development. So figuring out ways for investors to gain the most efficient exposure to the asset class. And then, of course, supplementing that with sort of educational research and tools for them to better understand why they should be allocating.
Makes total sense. Go Phillies. I lived in Philly for a while. That's a cool city. Good people down there. Love it. David, how about you let folks know about your background and the work that you do out at ARK?
I joined ARK about over a year and a half ago, but been full-time in the crypto space since 2017, middle of it or so. First came to it as, for its political and financial value propositions, especially Bitcoin. And then during 2018, I turned into what is now called on-chain analysis, which is what I'm most known for in this space. And with Willy Wu and Murad Mahmoudov and other researchers at the time, I published a ton of research on that. A lot of the metrics that you see on your Glassnode or CoinMetrics, I had the fortune of authoring or co-authoring some of those metrics. And then gearing up to, 2022, I was lucky enough to find ARK and Yasin, and been, happy ever since, helping with both research and product development as well.
So you must spend time then speaking with Will Clement, who I see a lot on
Twitter.
Sure.
For sure, a good friend. Good friend of ours.
Yeah, there's some excellent analysis and research that I guess that corner of the Bird app does. That's super fun. I mean, it's fascinating stuff. We're going to get into it later in the episode, but like we should probably set things up earlier on. Each year, ARC puts out a big ideas report, and it has a series of technology trends that you folks keep an eye on. There's a few here that are directly relevant to our discussion today, four of them to be exact. Public blockchains, Bitcoin, digital wallets, and smart contract networks. You see, if I could just ask to kick things off, how do you folks see the space? There are four different technology trends, but they intersect. And like, what is your view writ large around what's going on in that part of like technology?
Yeah, I think when we kind of take a step back, what we like to assess is the fundamental value proposition of a specific technology. And with regard to public blockchain infrastructure, the way that we're looking at, especially this migration from the physical to the digital world, what this infrastructure serves as. And effectively, it's the backbone of a new form of economic coordination that we think minimizes the need to trust centralized institutions. I'm looking at the top of this Riverside and I see Crypto Clarified investing in the truth. And I think that like really encapsulates a lot of what this fundamental value proposition is. We often hear the tagline, like, don't trust, verify, don't trust, verify. I think in a world where, you know, we've come to unfortunately need to rely on these, you know, trust-based third parties to facilitate economic coordination, when you introduce a decentralized, open source, user-run, permissionless network to facilitate the economy, that's a very profound and what we like to call a big idea. So when you think about the permissionless characteristics of public blockchains, the open, the decentralized characteristics of public blockchains, lowers the cost of coordination. And we find that that most profound impact really begins with Bitcoin or money. You know, when you think about the novel form of self-sovereign, censorship-resistant money, disrupting the world of fiat currencies and providing an alternative to central banks. But it really doesn't stop there, as you kind of alluded to. You have Bitcoin that has birthed massive innovation across multiple revolutions outside of just that money use case. And that is, you know, a financial revolution and an internet revolution. You know, with regard to the financial revolution, the ability to coordinate financial services and contracts outside the purview of traditional services and financial institutions. And then the internet revolution kind of alluded to smart contracts, but the ability to kind of facilitate the coordination of identity, of reputation, and of data outside of traditional media conglomerates. So it's been really interesting to just see the evolution of these revolutions. But the way that we encapsulate that in really simple terms is this solves a really interesting coordination problem.
It makes total sense that you would see it like that. If you've got a background in systems engineering and economics, like it's unmistakable what's happened if you look at it through those two lenses. Absolutely. Different ways for people to coordinate and share information with each other in kind of a trustless fashion. Of course, there are other elements where you've got to, we can get into that later around where trust plugs in. And of course, my background is cybersecurity. It's always top of mind. But before we go to that, David, you do on-chain analytics. So when we talk about public blockchains and Bitcoin, smart contracts, we're talking about open source software, distributed databases. Can you let the listeners just kind of know what it is at a technological level, and then the way in which those open networks and open source software allow visibility to outside parties, which allows folks like you to do the on-chain analysis that you do.
Well, yeah. So as you mentioned, one of the main value propositions of Bitcoin and other crypto assets, not all, but most of them, is transparency. That public ledger that is crucial and core to that technology becomes a way to see into it and the behavior of the network participants at any given time. And that transparency provides a lot of potential for diagnoses and analysis related to, the behavior of the participants and the inner economics of that given blockchain. So you could think about it as a middle point between a way to analyze the real world versus price on the other end. That middle point becomes on-chain analysis to some extent in terms of diagnosing that everything in the network is working correctly for stuff, right? Supply is being, issuance is taking place at the agreed upon schedule. Hash rate is healthy, for instance, as a proxy of security of the network. And also it gives you a sense of supply and demand dynamics at any given time.
The visibility that one gets into these networks is really kind of fascinating when you compare it to traditional markets and ways in which people store and obscure information. Like that visibility in of itself is a value prop straight up. But before we go deeper down that rabbit hole, it's probably worth, for the listener's sake, just tracing out. You've seen for public blockchains and smart contract networks, we're talking about open networks, we're talking about distributed databases, but there's lots of them and they're kind of different in the way they're configured. You just trace out in loose terms, like in your mind, how are they different? Why are they different? And how should listeners look at all of these various networks out there?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, especially relative to, where the opportunities lie. I like to answer this question from more of a top down of looking at the different revolutions. So the monetary, financial, and internet revolution is how we've segmented it. And ultimately, the building blocks of that revolution are going to require sort of different trade-offs in how the system is actually built. So when you think about something like, Bitcoin, which is this almost rules-based self-sovereign money, the ethos and how the system is built is quite conservative and simple and relies on sort of design goals that preserve monetary integrity and are highly decentralized. And in the case of Bitcoin, there's this founder myth. So the issuance isn't in the way that we've seen with other public blockchains. But when you go across the spectrum to call it more open or composable or permissionless use cases, the ethos there is much more progressive, experimental, and optimized for functionality and scalability. So when you think about consensus algorithms like proof of work versus proof of stake, it's like does a proof of work algorithm make sense for a high throughput smart contract platform versus something like, a proof of work where you just want to send, small bits of data that are high fidelity, that are irreversible. And so, we kind of assess the trade-off between really decentralization and security and sort of use cases and functionality. So call it the more narrow you are, call it the higher assurances you might have, but the less you can do. And so that's kind of the trade-off that we're assessing. I also want to just circle back to one of the points that you made on looking at just more status quo infrastructure and how transparency is almost like a byproduct of how these systems are built. And oftentimes I've found like the best way to really understand that value proposition is by understanding how more centralized systems and status quo infrastructures operate, right? When you think about, how central authorities, they're the ones that mediate network activity versus in a decentralized use case, you have, distributed computer nodes that are, mediating network activity. When you think about what closed source actually means, it's that the rules of the network are determined behind closed doors at the discretion of companies or platforms or regulators. What open source means is that the network rules are open and they're auditable and they're coordinated by users and, effective stakeholders. Even things like the idea of what it actually means to be permissioned versus permissionless. Like permissioned, you have geography, you have regulation that control the access, there are explicit borders. Permissionless, there's anyone, with access to the internet that can participate and innovate here. So, when you're thinking about on-chain analytics and what it actually is, it's really just a byproduct of being set up in the way that these public blockchain networks have been set up. And contrasting it with sort of traditional status quo infrastructure, I think, is an additional interesting angle to really just highlight the value proposition of these open networks.
There's a couple of interesting ideas in there. One of them is that the technology doesn't come from nowhere, that people build right. them for different purposes, and you face engineering trade-offs as a consequence. There's another element there that you're hinting at, and that is something, David, you mentioned earlier. It's kind of you were interested in the politics of it to start with. And this is the part where Sam and James in compliance, don't send me a memo bringing up politics. But there is a certain... It reminds me of Richard Stallman and the free open source movement. David,
well, if anything, it's apolitical. It's political. It's political neutrality. If we don't want to talk about politics, it's like the whole idea is that you're agnostic to the politics. Like Bitcoin and free and open source software doesn't really care. It's going to operate based on, you know, code. And I think eliminating that sort of human subjectivity is why, from a political standpoint, it's actually so interesting. David, what do you think? Because I know you're down the rabbit hole of sort of cypherpunks and
So cypherpunks. Well, that's an obvious reference, and we cannot not talk about cypherpunk culture when talking about Bitcoin, especially. Yeah, double negative, whatever. But basically, in terms of what I meant by political, for me, it was a major achievement just to see how Bitcoin managed to do two things at the same time. One was to have a very, it's not apparently neutral. It's more like, let's say in terms of accessibility, it was very much neutral, right? The network doesn't care if you're Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, whatever. You have equality and opportunity in accessing it, both from a standpoint of buying it, mining it, especially way back in 2010, 9, 10, 11. But also, I really found interesting how it managed to achieve a shelling point and gridlock throughout time. And that was the basis for basically achieving or preventing game theoretical attacks every single second for, you know, basically 14 years almost. That was very interesting to me, how it was organic enough to give access to all while preventing, something apart from a market affecting it substantially.
Let's hit on that point there, shelling point. We're starting to get into game theory stuff there. Just for the listener's sake, you say the shelling point there. Just give them a quick taste on that concept. They can go to Wikipedia and see it, of course, but that is an important concept, actually.
Yeah, in game theory, in essence, and at a very high level, it's where you have several interests, some of them may be nefarious from different actors, and you manage to devise a system, perhaps organically or not, where those adversarial interests of the participants manage to result in cooperation, given the incentives of the system. I think that gets the job done at a high level.
Yeah. And it's kind of a feat to have achieved. I call it the most adversarial software environment out there, except maybe like military systems. Everyone's trying to break it and try to find ways to game it. And if you can get people to cooperate, essentially, mediated via digital technology, it's really quite a feat. And anything that survives in that environment over time is doubly impressive.
The Holy Trinity of what you would like to attack if you're a nefarious actor: money or finance in general, nukes and electrical grids, right? Energy in some way. So Bitcoin got to at least achieve equilibrium in one of them.
Lots of competing interests. And then it's a little bit like capitalism in a way that you've got to get people to act in their own self-interest in a way that doesn't damage others and creates greater prosperity as a consequence of the cooperation between the different actors. You know, the other one that comes to mind, it's, I don't know if you two have looked at Stafford Beer, who put together something called Project Cybersyn in Chile in the early 70s. Like, again, it was this kind of, all right, so that's a Wikipedia job there. Oh, there's some great books, actually.
No, I'd love to hear about it.
No.
Okay, let's do that.
Who's Stafford?
So if we think about like technology as a byproduct of whatever our capabilities are at a point in time, and there's also like a political and social dimension and an economic dimension. So Stafford Beer was a consultant in the United Kingdom in the early 70s, and he was asked to come to Chile by the government, Salvador Allende. And basically they looked at the technology they had at the time, and they wanted to create a system whereby you could almost get, it's almost cybernetics. You get feedback from parts of the country in order to coordinate the economy and then pull in information from people about whether they're happy or unhappy with how things are being conducted.
Without them communicating whether they're happy or unhappy? It's like there's ultimately a different signal to communicate whether they're happy or unhappy. Is that?
Yeah, they had like a dial. So you could dial like this thing, like it or I don't like it. And as a consequence, you get this feedback mechanism that feeds into the central government and helps them like in an optimistic way, try and calibrate economic policies to maximize people's well-being. Go and check it out because they've got this great like hub. It's something out of like Star Trek, with these like vinyl chairs and like red carpets and things. And that's where all the data came in for them to kind of make these decisions. They used telex machines at the time. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is if you know about cybernetics and you know about like the evolution of technology, you see these experiments over time. Some of them are successful and some of them fail, either for their stated goals or they're co-opted. And so when you see something like Bitcoin comes along and then like, as you said, you've got the shelling point dynamic, the game theory, you've got to get all these competing interests to cooperate and it survives. It's kind of not an easy feat is, I guess, what I'm angling at. And it's kind of very deliberate in the way in which it's designed to start with and changed over time. And we watched this process playing out with all of these different smart contract networks. You said like the Bitcoin network's really, really hard to change and rightfully so. They're live experiments, in essence, or economic experiments playing out in front of us. And the good ideas succeed and the bad ones disappear and everything keeps rolling on. But alas, I'm going down the rabbit hole. I told you that technology history was going to come up. I tried to relent, but I can't help myself.
Love it.
let's turn the episode now towards the second half, and that's on-chain analytics. Now, I started my career at the OECD. I used to work around like national statistics and they're an absolute mess. And someone has to clean them up, make them comparable across countries over time. And so, you know, that's part of the reason the OECD exists and the United Nations Statistics Division. But we've got, so it's messy. Data can be messy. It's hard. But we have a new source of data here. And David, I know that you're the expert here. When you approach the opportunity to collect on-chain data, what are you looking at? How are you thinking about it? Which metrics do you collect? Why and which ones do you discard?
Well, I'll start by saying what sort of data on-chain analysis collects in essence. It's basically three things. And out of that, you can get a bunch of metrics, indicators, and analyses. The first one would be volume, meaning the number of coins at any given address or transaction. Think about it as what percentage of the supply is at any given place or takes place at any given time. The second would be addresses, which may be confused by for users, but it's not really that. It's in essence the by accounting the holder that collects the coins after any given transaction. And the third one, which is perhaps equally important as the first, time, or let's say stamping, which is you can assign a specific time where a coin last moved, or a specific price where that coin last moved. So by the since part of the value proposition of Bitcoin is having a sort of system of checks and balances and assets and liabilities of any given address, and it tracks transactions from inception by design, you can then subtract the holding periods of every individual coin at any given time. And that gives you a lot of information. And conversely, you can also track the price of it. So it's pretty much time stamping or price stamping. Out of that, you can get, you know, right now, I think it's over 100 metrics that you can see on your Glassnode or Conmetrics. But yeah, for the most part, imagine having, I'll give you two examples perhaps of metrics that are widely used and can you give a more traditional investor reference. So one would be realized cap, for instance. Opposite to market cap, which is simply supply of the asset times price at the current moment, realized price takes every single coin or the supply and multiplies that by the price with where that coin last moved or was bought, right? We assume that it moved and that transaction occurred in a new buy that takes the cost basis of the market higher or lower. So if you add them all together, you in essence have the cost basis of the market for the most part. So what traditional investors have been trying to do with mean reversion mechanisms like the 200-day moving average, the yearly moving average, or something like that, you can actually get a sense of actual cost basis based on actual data, not an estimation of that or a derivation of price, and get a fundamental sense of where the market as a whole last bought. To give you the other example, which is in the time domain, this is an example of price stamping. In terms of time stamping, you can go to a metric like Coin Days Destroyed, which is in essence a fungible unit of account, you can think of it, where each coin, depending on when it last moved, is given more preponderance on the system. So for instance, imagine I send you 2 Bitcoins today. And then after a week, you send those 2 Bitcoins back to me, right? So it's 7 days, 2 Bitcoins. Basically what Coin Days Destroyed does is it multiplies both units of account to give another unit. So in this case would be 2 times 7 equals 14, 14 days destroyed. And that in aggregate gives you a sense of if you see a lot of coin days destroyed at any given day, there's a lot of old coins moved perhaps for months to years to even a decade now. And those are being moved and most likely being released into circulation again, right? Which would be more of a bearish environment. And conversely, if you see a lack of those over time, it's usually suggestive that the liquidity is restricted in the system and whatever Bitcoins are left in circulation, maybe up for grabs, right? Which could be a predictor for price appreciation. So those are some basic examples of how granular it can get. And on top of that, you can iterate and transform a lot. as I've said, it's over 100 metrics at this point.
Yeah, it's a lot to take in. I appreciate you explaining at least two that you keep a close eye on, because there is so much information out there. It might be easy to get consumed by noise, but there is signal if you know where to find it. Yassine, do you use any of the on-chain metrics when you do your analyses or try to monitor the ecosystem?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe taking another just step back, because I want to go back to a point that you made, Benjamin, on the data room that you were interfacing with, and how there was sparse data, and you know the data is not necessarily as reliable or incomplete. I think the best analogy for what sort of on-chain data offers is exactly in the way that like a government statistical agency might publish data about a country's population or economy, or you have a public company that's going to publish, you know, quarterly financial results. Bitcoin and public blockchain networks are offering kind of this real-time global fact sheet that publishes data about the network's activity and the inner economics. And so what David effectively alluded to was the ability to extremely granularly assess buyer and seller behavior. And when you think about what drives price at the margin, it really is reservation demand. And so when you're like an active manager or an active allocator, you can use sort of a lot of these metrics in the same way that you might use like an EV to EBITDA multiple when assessing the relative valuation of a company. So, you know, we're using this on a daily basis, and it really depends on, you know, how exactly, you know, we might use this. So the most fundamental rudimentary data that's pretty much raw that you can scrape from sort of a node, it helps to assess just general network health, right? So you want to see things like, you know, the predictability of monetary policy. Is Bitcoin, you know, really on average producing a block every 10 minutes? Imagine being able to like, you know, have the same for the Fed or a central bank of, you know, is the monetary policy as predictable as they claim it to be? What sort of volumes, what's the transaction count? But you can to actually further manipulate that data and get into things like cost basis, like what, you know, David alluded to, or a time-weighted turnover, which is, you know, coin days destroyed. And that actually helps to assess the buyer and seller behavior. I think the way to actually highlight that is, you know, David gave the example of, if I send you 2 Bitcoin and you send me a 2 Bitcoin 7 days later, you know, that'll give you 14 coin days destroyed. But what if I send you 2 Bitcoin and you send me those 2 Bitcoin 7 years later? That has a much more potentially significant impact on the broader market in a way that we might not recognize if we didn't have that sort of timestamp. So imagine again being able to like look at the Tesla shareholders and seeing exactly when they bought and for how long they pulled and when they're selling and who they're transferring to. And imagine that the only sort of mechanism by which to value Tesla, or the only driver of a Tesla stock, was buyer and seller behavior. Well, that's what you have with Bitcoin. So on-chain data for us is really, really important and interesting to assess relative valuation. And then one step above that, you can then sort of actually actively manage and trade around the volatility, which is something that, you know, we often do, where you see a massive spike in coin days destroyed. 100,000 Bitcoin that hasn't been moved in 10 years is now being moved. Are those Satoshi's coins? What are the implications? For instance, like that actually drives price at the margin. And so there are a lot of inefficiencies that I think, on-chain data helps to highlight. And then on top of that, and I'll finish with this, when you think about these assets as independent assets in the broader sort of traditional asset class spectrum, where Bitcoin, Ethereum, they don't really fit neatly in sort of a traditional asset class framework, like a bond or an equity or a traditional commodity, a lot of investors are wary of gaining exposure, admitting that it is an asset, that it is a separate asset class, because they don't really understand how to fundamentally analyze and value the asset class. And I think part of that is because the way to do that is on-chain data, And on-chain data is a completely independent and novel sort of framework for analyzing that quite simply just doesn't exist in other frameworks. So from an allocator standpoint as well, I think that, you know, we're starting to see perhaps a change of tune in just the importance of using on-chain data to assess fundamentals.
There's another wrinkle to that as well, which is that the database doesn't lie. So, yeah, you know, you pore over accounting statements, you're looking at the footnotes, you're trying to find, you know, where some funny business is going on.
With and the on-chain data, not only that, it's also like 24/7. You have 10-minute block granularity, not as opposed to quarterly reporting or something like that.
Yep, indeed. And it's just no wonder I thought of Project CyberSyn, because that was in 70s version in a national economy of essentially doing what you said you've seen, a global network that anyone can watch the movements on.
Right.
And
there's a radical honesty to it. It's quite reflective relative to, you know, what we're akin to.
Let's see if we can poke some holes in it then. So one element that I kind of find interesting then is once things move to exchanges, then on the back end, you usually don't see the movements. How do you kind of think about that? Because, you know, there's plenty of data sets where you have to clean them up and make adjustments and take into account what's going on. Do you have a view then on like the distorting factors that could be out there? I only ask because I myself, when I sit down with the data, I have to think about it so we make sensible decisions. But you two are the experts, so I'd leave it to you. Maybe David first.
Sure. Yeah, as with any time series and data source, there's noise. But one first point would be, for the most part, when you're doing market analysis and dealing with on-chain data, you're dealing with aggregates. So it's very hard to either manipulate or the data being perverted, you could say, in any way by a single actor or a single entity. And to give you the Satoshi example that Yasin mentioned, if Satoshi is actually moving, given that Satoshi entity holds a lot of the supply, then it's actually pertinent to the market. It's actually a news event, right? So you would want to know specifically that. There's a lot of ways to transform the data and diminish its noise, as simple as applying medians and moving averages. That's the lowest hanging fruit of that. But on top of that, there's also, a nuance in the analyst to differentiate, truly economic transactions and movements or behaviors on the network versus what could be, for example, an exchange making an internal churn for security and maintenance reasons. To give you a very specific historical example, this was late 2018. So the price was about 3,000, 4,000, right? This was after a major correction and bear market over that year. And then pretty much at the global bottom at the time, Coinbase churned a big chunk of their supply, right? The exchange. And what that produced is a lot of volume on-chain measurements like Coinbase Destroyed spiked a lot because some of the coins had remained dormant for a while, but perhaps even more pertinent, it was a lot of coins, right? Because it was part of most of their wallet aggregation. So that was a disclosed news event where, for the most part, you as an analyst has to distinguish that period in time. Let's call it a false signal or a source of noise, and you adjust. Eventually, for the most part, since you're dealing with aggregates, the data smooths itself out to portray real economic activity. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is more sophisticated entity adjustment. So you have firms like CoinMetrics, like Glassnode, et cetera, who are getting very good at dealing with what you could call in the industry address clustering or entity adjustment, which is pretty much identifying manually and via machine learning what are the different addresses held by a single owner or a single entity. It could be a whale, like an early adopter that mined a bunch of Bitcoin in 2011, or it can be an entity like Coinbase or Bitstamp or whatever exchange, right? Or a custodian. Now, the level of sophistication goes to where the way the transactions between those addresses behaves, you can detect when those addresses cluster into a single entity and filter out the transactions between those addresses. So basically what you get is you only filter or not filter the transactions from that address into another counterparty in the network. And that gives you a sense of true economic behavior, right? As opposed to just wallets being churned internally for security reasons or whatever. So there's a lot of sophistication throughout the years, and it's increasing. And ultimately, it's also a part of the job of the analyst to you know, filter out noise from the signal.
Yeah, it's a whole job, that, isn't it? You've got to handle the data carefully to find the signal, not get kind of the noise creeping in and distorting the kind of how you interpret what is and is not going on. Yassine, do you like just thinking about actionable stuff?
Sure. I mean, I think to your point, the data cannot just be looked at in its rawest form, and market dynamics will actually change the legitimacy of that data. You kind of alluded to that, where, you know, if most users that end up going on centralized exchanges and they're transferring between you know, each other on that exchange, that technically isn't accounted for in transaction volume, and yet has become a big part of, you know, economic activity. So as the dynamics change, or even something like the Lightning Network, right? If I'm like settling on the Lightning Network and I'm transferring, you know, between one channel and the other, that's not really settled on chain. And so there might be a distortion of, let's say, lower transaction volume relative to what's actually happening on the economic level. Or conversely, like kind of David alluded to, you might see massive volumes of just between exchanges as sort of security protocol, and yet you know, there wasn't actually an explicit transfer, so there needs to be an adjustment there. The most basic adjustments that, you know, that we've seen, which David alluded to, was like number of addresses does not equal number of users. So over time, there's going to need to be an adjustment there as well. So all that to say, if the goal is to poke holes here, there are certainly holes in that the data, some data in some metrics have, and we expect will lose signal just based on just broader market dynamics. And then the question then becomes, as the analyst, like, how are you able to reconcile what the market is telling you with what the data is telling you to come up with sort of more relevant and novel metrics? So the metrics that are relevant today, I don't actually think will be necessarily relevant in 5 years. And the metrics that were relevant 5 years ago, I'm thinking things like NVT ratio, right? The network value to transaction volume ratio. That was a ratio that everyone was, you know, all over a few years ago. It actually lost a lot of signal because of the migration to centralized exchanges. And that's no longer sort of an industry, a metric that's used by the industry. One of the more prevalent examples.
One of the ones that has my eye at the moment is the Ethereum layer twos. So someone sent me across on-chain transaction activity on the Ethereum base layer the other day, which is declining, and put it up against Bitcoin. I said, well, you can't really compare them. Yeah. I mean, there is Lightning for Bitcoin, so that's somewhat close. But I said, if all of the transactions are migrating to these layer twos And listeners, if layer two confuses you, join us next month because we're having the folks from Base on, Coinbase's deployed layer two for Ethereum. I guess in short, because I know we're running up on time, when you're batching transactions and then making one transaction on the base layer to represent or store several transactions all bundled together, of course the base layer transaction numbers are going to go down. But if you don't see the bigger picture and you don't understand that, and you've seen, as you say, it changes over time, then you won't know how to interpret the data correctly. But if you do know where to look and you do know how to understand it, you're seeing a massive shift in the ecosystem happening right now. But again, we're coming up on time, so we can't nerd out on that too much, unfortunately. Maybe something for another episode one day. But given that we are coming up on time, and given that we always like to finish up these episodes thinking about the future with a capital F, because the future is interesting. David, Yassine, what have you got your eye on at the moment? What is the most interesting thing? It can be within the space, it can be outside. Listeners always love to hear this. What are people who are deep down the rabbit hole experts interested in and curious about? David, we kick off with you, and then Yassine will close up with you, if that's all right.
We have a paper coming up, actually, which will be quite interesting to get your thoughts. Goes back to the time stamping that we measured in related to Coinbase Destroyed. So I have a would like to get the feedback from readers on that. In terms of interesting to me is perhaps solving first fungibility for Bitcoin. I think it's still a low hanging fruit that has not been fully solved, especially at the protocol level. And then perhaps a little bit more, way more into the future, the game theoretical aspects of quantum and how they could affect Bitcoin down the road into more of a between five and 20 year time horizon. Those and just in general, I don't know, how AI is affecting art. It's top of mind as well. I think that's about it.
That's good. Listeners, sorry, we're not going into lattice-based frameworks today and quantum-resistant cryptography. But if people want it in the future, we can do that. But Yassine, I know we're coming up on time, so I'd leave the floor to you to finish things up. What have you got your eye on?
Sure. I mean, for me, I think when I look at the dynamics of 2022, just the broader space and what people were focused on, I think it was quite disheartening to see. Just some of the incentives that were at play, you know, where investors were allocating capital, just the broader sort of cycles of fear and greed, and that, I'd say the momentum had and the pendulum was really shifting towards an industry that didn't really pride itself on sort of the ethos that it was founded upon. So what interests me is kind of shifting back that pendulum to kind of an ethos that, you know, prides itself on, you know, honesty, radical transparency, and truly like enabling the freedom of wealth transfer and transaction and the ability to store value across time and space. So right now I'm kind of looking at more, you know, emerging market use cases, going back to the basics, not really following the hype, and looking at this industry from really where we started. So that has been top of mind for me as we saw the washout in 2022, and into 2023. But the future, capital F future, is certainly bright, and excited for what's to come.
Yeah, the animal spirits were well and truly in motion, and the bad part is you get the bad parts, so circular logic, but you see a lot of misallocated capital and things that don't work. And I'm glad that noise is now much, much lower. And yeah, we are in that point in the cycle where people are actually building useful things that can find product market fit ultimately is what kind of projects.
That's perhaps the best part about 2023. It's just quiet.
What interests you, Benjamin? Let's finish off on what interests you.
Well, I've got a stack of books here about genomics at the moment. And I mean, our genes are essentially encoded information. And it's starting to get to a point where you can kind of sequence your own genome, the DNA. That's where the technology's at. And it's really just information stored in a cellular form rather than on a distributed ledger. But that's what my stack of books has here.
Love it.
I'll have to let you know in the future how that goes. But it's something that's got my eye just because it's kind of interesting to think about the questions around where it comes from and how it evolves over time. But that's a whole episode in it itself. And we are at time, listeners. Yassine, how can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at Yassine Arc on Twitter, X, however you want to call it.
Twitter, it's always going to be the Bird app to me. So
the Bird app, that's what I'll say. Twitter.
All good. David, how about you?
It's Deepwell Arc, same on Twitter, Bird app X.
Wherever people are doing on-chain analytics in the corner of X, you can find David. It's good stuff. You've seen, I also follow you on Twitter, so it's good stuff as well. But with that, we are out of time. I hope everyone found today's podcast useful and informative. I sure did. WisdomTreePrime.com. Check it out. Apple Android stores. It's very cool. Find me on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. David, Yassine, thank you very much. Thank you to the listeners for tuning in. I hope everyone has an excellent day.